Thanks for coming, everyone. Welcome to our second annual colloquium. First time we talked about NP complete problems and quantum algorithms. Today we're going to be talking about some particle physics. Okay. This is some first half of the talk is going to be things that I hopefully understand. Okay. This is the safe part. You can relax. I think I know what I'm doing. Second half is much more speculative, but also much more fun. And some of the things that we learned in the first half are going to be useful for the second half, so pay attention. So let's get started, okay? History of hadrons. By around 1960, we had discovered about 100 particles, a zoo of particles. As soon as we turned on our colliders, brand new particles were popping into existence. And they obeyed some familiar conservation laws, you know, charge conservation, good old classic, tried and true. But something strange was going on, okay? And this strangeness was proposed to describe some new conserved quantity of the particles that we were discovering. And with this, Gell-Mann plotted the isospin and the strangeness of the particles that we observed. And he noticed some very geometric distributions of the way that the particles that we discovered arranged themselves when plotted with strangeness and isospin. We now understand that the y-axis is hypercharge, strong hypercharge, and the x-axis is strong isospin. Okay, so hypercharge, isospin, these are what the particles look like. Now, at the time, this was missing, but he saw this and said, there has to be something there. And sure enough, soon after, the lambda baryon was discovered. So what these are weight diagrams of representations of SU3, okay? So he found that the reason that these particles distributed themselves like this is because there's an internal symmetry, SU3, governing the actual structure of the hadrons, okay? So this SU3 is the SU3 of up, down, and strange. And we now believe that this is like an approximate symmetry. It's somewhat accidental. And this is because the masses of the up, down, and strange are comparable. So when you produce particles, there seems to be an SU3 symmetry of up, down, and strange that causes the hadrons to arrange themselves like this. These are pseudoscalar mesons made of a quark and an antiquark. These are baryons made of three quarks or three antiquarks. And different spins take different representations under SU3. Okay? Now, are all the particles that we have mesons or baryons? Could there be quarks or particles made of four quarks or five quarks or six quarks? This is a very good question. For a while, it was not believed that these existed. But we now think that there's no reason that they can't exist in the standard model. But if they do exist, they would require very high energies to actually be produced in collider experiments. And only very recently in the 21st century has the LHC reached the energies required to actually produce these things. So it's a wide open active area of research trying to classify the tetraquarks, the hexaquarks, and above in a similar way to the hadrons that we know and love. So this is what I'm going to be doing, is I'm going to be using real data from the LHC and searching for bound states of four, five, or six quarks. And we might find something interesting. Okay, so this is work that I did in 2020. Okay, so up till now, all known matter is made of two or three quarks, mesons or baryons. Now, if we were just looking for clean signals of things that came from particles consisting of more than three quarks, then a very good thing that we can look at is a tetraquark decaying into two short-lived kaons, okay? And this is because these kaons then decay into two charged pions, and these charged pions are very easy to detect. They bend in our magnetic fields, we can measure their momentum, and from that we can reconstruct what the energy of the kaon that produced them must have been. And if we get two of these kaons, then we can add them together and say what was the energy of the particle that decayed into these two kaons. Similarly, we can look at a pentaquark. This could decay into a kaon and a lambda. And a lambda is a baryon. So this would be five quarks. This would decay into two baryons. This would be six quarks. And so yeah, they're chosen just because their decay products are very visible. Lambda would decay into a proton and a pion, both charged, easy to observe in actual accelerator experiments, okay? Is this showing it? Okay. So the strategy is we're going to, all that we have are the outstates. That's all that we can see in our detector. So we're going to get two pions, see if they reconstruct a sensible kaon. And if they do, we're going to look at the same event and look for another kaon. And we're going to take these two kaons and see if they, it's possible that they came from a similar vertex and reconstruct what the energy of this vertex must have been. And at the end, we're going to get a distribution of masses, and we're going to search for resonances. Okay, so I'll show you what a resonance looks like in a second. Okay, so this is a resonance for our kaons. Okay, so I take two pions, and I, well, did I skip a slide maybe? No? Okay, so I take two pions, and I combine them, and I calculate the invariant mass of the particle that produced these pions. And I get a very sharp peak, right around 500 MeV. Now, the mass of these two pions is around 500 MeV from PDG. This would be the mass of the kaon. And this is the measured value that I get from my fit. So it's, I'm pretty damn sure that's a kaon that I'm looking at, right? and same with the lambdas, OK? I get a very sharp peak. So what these red lines are cuts that I place on my data. And I say anything away from these red lines has a very low chance of being a kaon or a lambda. But everything within those red lines, I'm pretty damn sure that's a kaon or a lambda, right? Like, I'm pretty certain. And this yellow part is the background. So we're also going to try to reduce the background as well. You might ask how I chose these red lines. I looked at it, and I put them there. This isn't like some like double-blind, like huge 1,000 people collaboration at CERN. This is me. I'm just looking at this stuff, and I'm placing cuts wherever I want. It's just sort of a preliminary search, right? I'm not some big collaboration. I'm just some dude, right? Some other cuts that we could place are not just on the invariant mass, but also on the distance traveled from the vertex, okay? So our kaon is produced at some distance from the primary vertex, and we can look at what the distribution of kaons and lambdas look as a function of distance, and we'll see that we get some real noise beyond a certain point, but a very sharp peak beyond a different point. So I'll place a cut there. Same with the transverse momentum, okay? So the transverse momentum is what the kaon has before it decays, and then I can reconstruct what the momentum of the pions would be when they are reconstructed, and I look at the difference between them. If they're very close, then they probably did come from that vertex. If they're very far apart, then they probably didn't come from that vertex. Similarly, we get an angle, the pointing angle. How close are these vectors in position or in direction? So we're going to be placing cuts on the direction as well. So at the end, we'll be very quite certain that they actually came from the same vertex, and you'll see why. Okay, so first cut we can do on distance traveled. Okay, so this is a histogram, a 2D histogram of the mass of my reconstructed particle and the distance from the primary vertex. Okay, so down here at very low distances, I get a bunch of noise, but I get a very sharp peak right at the mass of my kaons. So I'm quite certain everything above this red line is a kaon, so I'm going to place a cut there. Similarly, for my lambdas, I get the same sort of thing. I get a very noisy signal down here, but above this distance, I'm going to say that's, I'm pretty confident that's a lambda, okay? And same with the transverse momentum. This one, I didn't really know where to draw a line, and that lines were as much of a cut as I could do. Nowadays, I'd probably like draw a circle around there and like, you know, get some better statistics, whatever. But this is very preliminary. I did this in 4 months in 2020. But this one, we get a very clean signal right around the mass of the lambda. I can cut and say everything above there, I'm pretty sure, is a lambda. Also, when we reconstruct the difference, the angle between the momentum, the reconstructed momentum, and the path vector, I'm going to cut anything that is above, I'm going to allow anything where this cos of that angle is above this, which is very close, right? Okay, so I'm placing this cut. And this cut itself takes me from this huge background signal, this is all the data, down to this yellow line. So it's a good cut. It really gets rid of most of the signal that isn't my actual particles that I'm interested in. And then with the other cuts, I get a nice little peak there. And these are, I'm pretty sure, kaons. Similarly, I can do the same with my lambdas, and I get another one, but I didn't plot it, whatever. Now, there's some interesting other plots that we can do. I can plot the mass of my particle if it's reconstructed as a lambda versus the mass of my particle if it's reconstructed as a kaon, and I get some funky lines. So anything beyond this point, I can be pretty sure, is a kaon, because it's got this peak of mass here. And anything below this point, I can be pretty sure is a lambda, because it's got the mass of a lambda there. So again, just more cuts, really trying to clean my data, get a good signal. Okay. I can also cut on the lifetime. So I can look at the lifetime of these particles, how long do they live before they decay, and we see our classic exponential decay, and then it levels out. So I'm going to place a line here and say anything with a lifetime less than this is probably a lambda, anything beyond then might not be, or kaon, whatever, right? So now, this is what we get. We've done our reconstruction of our pions into kaons, and I've done this for multiple events for every, or multiple vertices for every event. Now it's time to take our two kaons, or our two lambdas, or our kaon and a lambda, and reconstruct it into the multi-quark, the thing that we're actually looking for. Okay? This one I didn't end up getting working. Again, 4 months, I was rushed. But I did reconstruct the lambda, the two lambda invariant mass, and the two kaon invariant mass, and I get a distribution like this. Okay? So nothing too interesting from here. You can't really piece out a signal from this. But we're going to go searching, okay? So how do we know if the data that I actually reconstructed is good, if it's actually a good sort of cut on all my data to get reconstructed momentums that I'm actually looking for, okay? So this is in a 2010 PhD thesis. They did the same reconstruction, and they found these little wiggles at very low mass, essentially, very high background, low mass. I asked my advisor what these were, and he said, mesonic resonances, and he wouldn't answer any more questions beyond that. But remind me, ask me at the question period what these are, and I'll tell you some ideas, okay? But these are mesonic resonances. We just see them. We don't know what they are, but we see them. And if I see these in my plot, then I know that I'm actually reconstructing the data well, and that I have a possibility of searching for tetraquarks in the higher energies, because we expect the multiquarks to be at energies way beyond this. Now, it's important to note that as we go higher in energy and we place all these cuts, the amount of data that we have decreases very rapidly. So I only ran this analysis on about 4 terabytes of data, but CERN has much more data than that. So in the future, I would love to actually reconstruct this on a lot more data and see if we actually see a clean signal. So this is my data up here. The fit is just to guide your eyes. It doesn't mean anything. But look at these peaks in this previous study. They match up exactly with the peaks in my reconstruction. So I'm pretty confident that the data that I have here is well cut and is a good representation of the things that I'm actually looking for. Similarly, there was another study, same thing, same peaks. And so I'm pretty confident that I'm seeing something that has the possibility of being a tetraquark at higher energies. So now, how do we look for them? I made a program. Again, this feels like the science equivalent of like cooking the books, you know? Like I'm basically, I plot a histogram, I fit a background, and then I look for deviations from this background. And I call that the significance of any bin in my histogram. So up here, this is just a test on the smaller ones. I fit this background, this blue dotted line, and then I look at the significance of each bin with respect to the background. And I get almost 5 sigma for these ones with this binning. But if I increase the bin width, then I get more significance. Look at that, 8 sigma. That's pretty damn significant, OK? But again, I have freedom to choose the bin width, and I have freedom to choose the scale at which I'm looking at these things. And I just run an algorithm that searches through a bunch of them, and I look for significant peaks, things that are statistically significant, okay? So this is not too interesting for the low mass case, but I'm going to let my algorithm free on the higher mass case and look for an interesting peak, okay? And that peak, just like how the peak told us that I was looking at kaons or lambdas, hopefully this peak might say there might be a tetraquark here or a hexaquark or anything like that, okay? All right, so this is what I ran it on. This is at higher mass. This is like 3,000 to 4,000 MeV. Again, I plot a background, and then I calculate the significance of these things. Terrible statistics, okay? One bin, but it's about 3 sigma significance, okay? One bin, I mean, look at one bin, that's pretty cool. But it's not a lot of data, right? So this is, after all my cuts, over at these high energies, I get about 240 events, whereas the background is about 200 events. So not a lot of data to work with. Ideally, I would run this on a lot more data, and we'd generate better statistics, and we'd actually see not just one peak, but if I had lower bin width, I might be able to see a distribution, and I might be able to say, look, there's actually a particle there, probably. Similarly, I get a little interesting peak in the lambda reconstruction. I wouldn't put too much significance on this one. It's real bumpy, you know. That one, kind of interesting, okay? Just for fun, let's look at what the invariant mass of this thing is, okay? It's about 3,800, almost 38, in between 3,800 and 3,900, okay? Right around there. So after this, I started looking to see if there's any evidence for other people seeing this resonance. And sure enough, there is. People in the Bell collaboration in 2003, found a resonance at this mass. And it didn't fit into the quark model at the time because of its quantum numbers, but we also weren't necessarily searching for tetraquarks. So this, we think, actually is a very good candidate for a tetraquark. And we can see, I did my work in 2020, but they've been determined by CERN in 2013, and the first evidence of the production in the Quark-Gluon plasma was reported by the CMS experiment in 2022. I beat them to it! And I didn't publish it because I didn't know how cool it was, but I think it's really cool. So I saw this resonance before them, which is fun. But this is where I conclude the, yes?
So how do you calculate?
Fit it. I just fit it to some very simple polynomial, like as low degree polynomial as I can. What was that?
It looks like we're done. It looks like we're done.
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember. This was 2 years, 3 years ago. I have no idea. But I know it wasn't rigorous. It was not like, I'm just, it's not like some, yeah.
But what, you're fitting to that small data set?
Well, so, I start with a ton of data, and then I take things that I'm quite confident are kaons and lambdas, and then I calculate what these would be if I added their masses together in the same way that I did for the pions and the kaons. And then I get a plot of the mass of that object that I reconstructed. And those were those big histograms. So then what we're looking for in particle physics is a statistically significant bump that would suggest that more particles are being produced at this energy than the rest of them. And what that means is that there's a particle being produced at this energy, or with this mass. So that's essentially what we're looking for, is I reconstruct the invariant mass of these objects, and then I search for a significant bump, essentially. So this concludes the part of my talk where I know what I'm talking about. Okay. So this is, feel free to ask me any questions. This is a classic gag in particle physics. You know, you go back up and then you put the standard model Lagrangian and you're like, ha-ha. It's still a great joke. I will keep it in there because it's fun. Okay. Any questions? Any questions? Is no one going to ask me about the mesonic resonance? Okay. This is where it gets fun, okay? My prof wouldn't tell me what they were, so I did some Googling, and I found an interesting paper. Is F1710 a glue ball? F1710 was the resonance, the second resonance that I saw, and it's a possible proposed glue ball. Now, a glue ball is a bound state of gluons that are expected because simulations in lattice QCD predict a spectrum of bound states of gluons. And this is right at the energy of the lowest energy resonance of a bound state of gluons. So I might have seen a glue ball with my own eyes, and you have too now. We just didn't know it. But that would be very interesting if it was actually a glue ball, because glue balls are fun. This concludes the part of the talk that I know some things. I know some things that I'm talking about, okay? Now let's go, yes?
How do you know that the resonances are the same as in these papers that you told us? By the analysis you showed, you're supposed to know all the quantum numbers because you are assuming the quantum numbers come from the tetraquark.
Yes. So basically, at this point, we can't say this is a tetraquark. But all that I'm doing is saying, if I take two kaons and I add them together, and if they come from the same vertex, then what is the energy of the thing that I reconstruct? So people have done this analysis in the past. This is the 2010 thesis. They didn't find any tetraquarks up at higher energies, but they see these well-known resonances at lower energies. So these have been, the lower energy resonances have been seen before. We're not exactly sure what they are, but yeah, look, F1710. This is the one resonance. This one, mesonic resonance, I don't really know. But you know, QCD is very interesting and very difficult, and there's lots of wild things happening at the lower energies that we can't necessarily predict. But the tetraquarks in that, we expect to have much higher masses than these mesonic resonances and stuff. So that's why we're searching at higher energy than these lower energy ones. But yeah, these are just well-known resonances that were a good check to see if I actually did my data analysis properly. And it looks like I did. All right, so, yes? So I saw that terribly not statistically significant bump. It's a one histogram or one bin. And I gave my code to a master student who then did this as their PhD thesis, or no, as their master's thesis, and they didn't see the resonance. But I think they would if they used more data. It's got to be there. It's got to be, you know? Other people have seen it. It's right at the right energy. Whatever, X3872. It was right at the right energy. So I think I saw it. But people will disagree. But I think with more data, it might come back. With particle physics, a lot of these things go away. Like a lot of people go, look, a new particle. And then more data comes and it's gone. Or look, a deviation from the standard model, and then it goes away and it's gone. So it's very hard to like hold on to these resonances, and they continue to grow and be statistically significant. But I think with more data, you might actually see a tetraquark there, which would be very cool. Which is like one of the first of its kind. Like very few tetraquarks have been proposed. Like they could probably count them on one hand or something. You know, like there's not many tetraquarks known or like suggested as particles actually discovered yet. So it'd be pretty fun. And so the question is, the way that Gell-Mann plotted all the mesons and the baryons, do the higher quark hadrons obey similar structures? And I assume that they probably do. But we don't know until we measure their quantum numbers and actually plot them on the same sort of graph, which is fun. Okay? Any last questions before we go off in the deep end? Okay. So this all came to me Friday afternoon after the Friday social, talking with many of you in this room. And I haven't been able to sleep since, basically. So this might be a little bit all over the place, but I hope you follow along and have as much fun as I do thinking of these things, okay? So we started with a lesson from Gell-Mann. Let's now take a lesson from Weinberg, okay? So this comes directly from electroweak symmetry breaking, okay? Electroweak symmetry breaking, great unification in physics, okay? It unified the weak force and QED and showed that they actually come from a deeper symmetry, the electroweak symmetry, okay? And this electroweak symmetry breaks into the U1 of electromagnetism of QED. But before then, they are their own gauge groups, and the fields transform under them. And after the symmetry breaking, we get a notion of electric charge. There's no such thing as electric charge before symmetry breaking. It's something that comes after, okay? Now, the electric charge, we now understand, to actually be a mixture of the hypercharge of this U1. Okay, so this is the standard model here. Good old standard model. We got these are the fermions of the standard model, okay? We got our left-handed quark doublet. It's a doublet under the SU2, okay? And it transforms as the fundamental under SU3 color. So it has color, the quarks have color. It's a doublet under SU2, and it has hypercharge 1/6, okay? So in the SU2, you get an isospin. And this is the fields coupling to the isospin. And this is the fields coupling to the hypercharge. And once you know these, the relative coupling, then you know how much of the electric charge is made of components of these two things, okay? So the electric charge of all of our particles is a mixture of the hypercharge and the isospin of the electroweak theory, this SU2 cross U1. Okay. So then these are all of our fermions in the standard model. I drew a box around the right-handed neutrino. It does not exist. It is not predicted by the standard model. I just wrote it here for fun and for no other reason. okay. And so, but it has a nice little structure. We got the quarks that transform under the fundamental of SU3. And we have the leptons, which are singlets under that. But we also have a doublet, a weak doublet, under SU2. And they all have their own hypercharges, okay? So this parameter that comes after electroweak symmetry breaking is a free parameter in the standard model. We can't predict it. You can read this little blurb. Note that at present, there is no generally accepted theory that explains why the measured value is so close to 29 degrees. It's 30. It's not 29. It's 30, okay? I promise you. It's pi over 6. it should be what it is. The specific value is not predicted by the standard model. The Weinberg angle is an open, free parameter, although it is constrained and predicted through other measurements of the standard model quantities. Okay, free parameter in the standard model. I don't think it's a coincidence that it's so close to pi over 6. I think it actually is pi over 6, and I'll tell you why. Here's where I'm going to leave this presentation. And we're going to come to a program that I made. Let's rerun this. If it wants to load. OK, behold, the standard model fermions plotted with their hypercharge and their isospin. Okay, this doesn't look that impressive. But this is because the Weinberg angle is a free parameter. It can be anything I want. The Weinberg angle tells me what the coupling to the hypercharge is with respect to the coupling to the isospin. It's a relative coupling. Okay, so that angle determines the scale, the relative scale of my axes. And it's a free parameter in the standard model. This is for small Weinberg angle. And this is for big Weinberg angle. Do you want to see what the measured value looks like? Are you ready? Measured value. Woo! Look at that. That's the measured value, OK? This is a plot of isospin and hypercharge, the same plot that Gell-Mann was doing with the baryons and the mesons, OK? The same plot. And what do we see? Very geometric shapes emerging, OK? This is very interesting, I think. I was staring at this plot for about a year. And only recently it occurred to me that if we single out the singlets under SU3 color, these are the ones that transform trivially under SU3 color. They don't contain color. They don't interact via the strong force, OK? This forms a very nice hexagon, a really, really nice hexagon, OK? So this is the hexagon that we see. Now, this is the measured value. This is pi over 6. Tell me which one's better. Measured value, pi over 6. This, I feel like I'm like under tension, like I'm like stressed out. And then this is like, oh, thank God, you know, this is a perfect hexagon. Perfect hexagon, OK? But if we want to interpret this as a weight diagram, just like Gell-Mann did for the hadrons, what would this be? This would be an octet. It would be the 8 representation of an SU3. But we're missing something. What would be at the center there? Right-handed neutrinos. Let's toss the right-handed neutrinos in there. We get a right-handed neutrino and a left-handed antineutrino. And we get a perfect octet of a different SU3. This SU3 that these form an octet under is not known. I don't know what it is. But I think it's there. And I think it's real. And I think that the Weinberg angle is measured to be so close to pi over 6 because it actually is pi over 6. It determines the relative coupling between these two axes and fixes the geometric structure of the way that the standard model fermions arrange themselves when plotted with their isospin and hypercharge, just like the baryons in the Gell-Mann eightfold way, OK? So this, I think, is very interesting, OK? Let's think, one second. let's think what happened when Gell-Mann predicted that there was an internal SU3 symmetry governing the structure of the hadrons. This led to the discovery, along with a measurement of the anomalous magnetic moments of the hadrons, the protons and the neutrons, okay? They had magnetic moments that were odd, very strange. And this, combined with the eightfold way, gave evidence that there was substructure to the hadrons, that there was actually something internal going on, an internal symmetry that give the structure to actually arrange itself in this in such a way. I would like to claim that this, along with the G minus two experiment, which is showing evidence for anomalous magnetic moments in muons, might provide evidence for lepton substructure, okay? I think that electrons might not be fundamental. I think just like the hadrons that we also believed to be fundamental for a brief while turned out to fall apart. They had internal objects which allowed them to take interesting geometrical shapes under hypercharge and isospin. Really, this is a weight diagram of an SU3 representation. This would be the octet, but there are other fields. What do the quarks take? Now, this looks much better with the right-hand neutrinos in it, doesn't it, right? it was missing that before. But this is a very interesting geometric shape, and I don't know the rest of the story. All that I see is this octet, which is the singlets under SU3 color. So the singlets under the SU3 color seem to form an octet in a different SU3. So this is very interesting. You can speculate as to why they would do this. I don't know. And I also don't know what the representation of the quarks or like the other bosons or the other fields would be. But it's very fun to think about. And I hope you agree that this is very interesting and worth exploring further. So a bit of a recap. I would like to claim the Weinberg angle is actually pi over 6. Right now, it's experimentally ruled out. The error bars rule out pi over 6. But just like many other measured values in particle physics, that oscillates. And I think with more data, it will fall exactly on pi over 6. This is my first prediction. Second prediction, this is really a real octet. This means that the leptons take a representation under a different SU3, not the SU3 color, a different one. So now, is this a new force? Is this a new gauge group? I don't know. Is there internal structure to the leptons? I also don't know. But I think we can do it again, just like Gell-Mann did with the hadrons. We can look at this and say, maybe there's internal structure to the fundamental fields that we believe we have in the standard model. So thank you very much. I hope you have no questions at all. All right. Well, you're not going to fight me on this? No?
So
that's the thing, is I don't think the Weinberg angle was always pi over 6. I think it only comes after symmetry breaking, and it just fell to the value that is pi over 6. So it at low energies, we get these very symmetric representations. But at high energies, there's no such thing as symmetry breaking in the electric weak. The Higgs has a symmetric potential. Everything's all fine. These work as independent gauge groups. But very soon after, like 10 to the minus 40 seconds after the Big Bang or something, then this symmetry breaks, and then we fall into this very geometric structure. So I think it also probably runs with energy scale, just like all of the other couplings in that. But I think this is fun. I think I can at least explain what is previously a free parameter in the standard model. So we decrease from like 32 to 31. Pretty cool. But there's probably many more free parameters if we include substructure of leptons. So I don't think I helped the case for the number of parameters. But I think it's interesting.
We just had a question over there.
Yes?
Hi, Cole.
Hi.
I just want to make sure I understand this graph correctly. So what do you mean by the hypercharge of the left-handed electron? Because after symmetry breaking, you only have the electromagnetic Q1.
Yes, so these are the hypercharges of the unbroken U1 of the electroweak gauge group. And these are the isospins of the SU2L in the gauge group. So you're right, they have no... Like, we only get a notion of charge afterwards. Like, just like how Gell-Mann drew lines of constant charge, these lines here connecting the left and right-handed fermions are also lines of constant charge. So it is the hypercharge that I'm plotting, but it's the hypercharge of the chiral fields before symmetry breaking. And after symmetry breaking, we get these lines of constant charge connecting our fermions into Dirac spinners.
All right. But the left-handed electron and the left-handed neutrino should have the same hypercharge, because before symmetry breaking, there was just left-handed leptons. Like, that's what's confusing me.
Before symmetry breaking, there was just left-handed leptons?
Like, you have LL, which is a doublet of SU2, and has different hypercharges.
Yes. Okay. I don't know if you can see here, but like the isospin is either like plus 1/2 or minus 1/2 based on whether they're at the top of the doublet or the bottom of the doublet, essentially. So all of our singlets under SU2 are on the line of zero isospin, but the doublets all are either plus 1/2 or minus 1/2 isospin. But we're normalizing this with respect to the hypergraph or the hypercharge axis, and then we know the Weinberg angle because it's measured, and this tells us where to put the actual isospin of the non-trivial particles under SU2.
I'll have to think about it, and maybe I'll talk later with you about it.
Yes?
So these SU3 that you're you think it is also like that is also part of symmetry breaking or not?
So it might really, I have no idea what it is. Your guess is as good as mine. But if we want to make a direct analogy with what was done in the 60s, it points to substructure of the fermions. So them arranging themselves in this plot of isospin and hypercharge would be no coincidence. It would be because they take a fundamental or take some representation under a different symmetry group. But what's interesting is that this is the electroweak hypercharge, and this is the electroweak isospin. If I look at what Gell-Mann plotted, this octet, the axes are swapped. So where this this would fall on the axis of hypercharge in Gell-Mann's distribution of the hadrons, this would actually fall on the isospin. So it's almost like in this other SU3, the roles of the hypercharge and isospin have swapped. Or possibly the hexagon was rotated. I think also if you rotate it by the Weinberg angle, you get an octet that looks like this. I don't know. But it's really, I have no idea what this means. Now, it's important to note that the symmetry of the SU3 that governs the hadrons is an approximate symmetry. It's a broken symmetry. And it's broken because the masses of the quarks are different. So it's an approximate symmetry. If I take the limit that my up, down, and strange are massless, then it becomes a perfect symmetry, an unbroken symmetry. But our fermions are not massless. So really, it's a broken SU3 that governs the layout of the hadrons. And this might be a similar sort of accidental symmetry of some internal structure of the leptons. I don't know. But because the neutrinos and the electrons have very different masses, but you know, comparable compared to like a top quark or something, you know? So, yes. And there's interesting questions such as, what is the eight representation, the eight-dimensional representation of SU3 color? These are gluons, bosons, right? But our fermion singlets under SU3 color, take the 8 representation in this different SU3. So I don't know what I'm talking about, but it would be interesting if you could sort of claim supersymmetry or something like this, where our bosons in one representation, our fermions in another representation. But the boson and fermion-ness comes from the Lorentz group, which isn't necessarily connected to the gauge groups. I don't know. But it's fun to think about. I don't really know what I'm doing. This is about as far as I got. So I don't know what the quarks are doing here. I don't know a lot of things. I don't know where the bosons take this representation in a different group and stuff like this. But I think this is pretty neat. We got the right-handed neutrinos, the Weinberg angles predicted, and electron substructure. That's pretty cool. Yeah?
Ooh. You think about the normalization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're actually in a better position than Gell-Mann was. Gell-Mann didn't have any way to relate the two axes. He just plotted them and saw that they formed these geometric structures. But really, he could have squashed the hexagon and stretched it, but he looked at it and said, that's a frickin' hexagon, right? We have a parameter that tells us what the relationship between the axes are. It's measured, and when we plot it, we get a very geometric thing. So I do think that the Weinberg angle, and thus the distribution of them, will change with energy scale. But it's at the low energies, where we describe these as fundamental fields, that they take this distribution after symmetry breaking. So yes, I think the Weinberg angle will change with energy scale, but at low energies compared to the Big Bang, this is what we get. So. Yeah, Weinberg didn't have the relationship between hypercharge and isospin that we have. We're lucky. You don't have to trust me that I'm representing this correctly. It's the Weinberg angle that tells me how to draw my axes. Any more?
Okay, thank God.